Kite. I was born in Miles City, Montana, July 15th, 1919. I had early grade school education in Montana, high school in Oak Park, Illinois. I had an undergraduate degree from Albion College in Albion, Michigan in 1942, and later went to law school at Northwestern University School of Law in Chicago, and graduated from that school with a JD degree in 1951.
When was the first time you came to Alaska?
I came to Alaska first in 1943, in June of 1943. I was most of a year out of undergraduate school. The war was on, and I got a job in war construction work on the what was then called the Alaska Highway, or the Alcan Highway, rather, now the Alaska Highway, working at a camp building the steel bridge over the Tok River near, over the Tanana River near Tok. And the bridge is still there, as far as I know. It's a very good bridge, the big double cantilever steel bridge. And I worked there that first summer of 1943. And then in the late fall, I became a part of a maintenance crew on the highway for the winter. And the camp was located at a little very small river or large creek, whichever you prefer, called Gardner Creek. And from that location, we maintained portion of the road from the Canadian border to the Northway turnoff. And I was an illustrious truck driver.
Was this part of the war effort?
Oh, yes. No, the highway, of course, was built as part of the war effort in order to get a land connection between the lower 48 and Alaska.
Were you in the service at the time?
No, I was not in the service. I had been through an induction center twice, and both times I was rejected because I was nearsighted. Not long after I came to Alaska in this work, all the physical requirements were changed, and I'm sure I would have gone in. But I was then in Alaska in what was then considered AA1 priority work, and communications with my draft board indicated that I should stay where I was. So I did. So I never was in the service.
Why did you decide to go to Alaska to do this work?
I'd always wanted to come to Alaska. Even since I was a little boy, I was fascinated with Alaska. And fresh out of high school, I wanted to come to the University of Alaska, which of course then was only in Fairbanks. This would have been the fall of 1938 to start college. And my father, with some wisdom now in retrospect, suggested that the University of Alaska was probably not a school of enough prestige to warrant whatever undergraduate work I wanted to go into, and that the undergraduate the courses for anything other than into mining seemed to be very, very limited. So I went to Albion instead, which is a very strong, fine, smaller school in Michigan, and took my four-year course there. And then my father had told me, he said, if you still want to go north when you're through with your education, you graduate from Albion, I won't stand in your way at all. And I did graduate. He died very soon after that. And I came north then the next spring, in June of 43. Well, I came first to Seattle by rail, a very long and miserable trip because during the war times passenger trains were very bad and very crowded, and you sat up all the way. I was with a group. I took the train to Waterloo, Iowa, where the little contracting company I had signed a contract with was headquartered. Weldon Construction Company was the name of it, W-E-L-D-O-N. I have no idea whether they still exist or not. And from Waterloo, at Waterloo, I joined forces with about 15 other hirees, and we went from there on the train up to Minneapolis and across the northern part of the country to Seattle. And we were in Seattle for a couple of days, and then we were hustled onto the back of trucks with our suitcases and backpacks in the rain in Seattle in mid-June, and down to the docks and onto an old troop carrier that had been seized from the Germans in World War I. And the name of the boat was the Otsego, O-T-S-E-G-O, a miserable tub. And we joined forces there also with many, many other hundreds of construction workers that were hired by other companies for work not only on the Alcan Highway, but on the various airfields like Ladd Field and so forth that were under construction at that time during World War II. And so the ship was entirely full of construction workers. And we set out from Seattle and sailed across the Gulf and landed at Valdez. And on June 27th, 1943, in a driving, pouring rain, and they called your company, and you had to wait, and they called the various companies, and if you were contracted with that, you came, and there was a truck waiting there who would drive you to whatever part of the territory you were engaged in your work. And finally, Weldon's name was called, and the 15 or so of us trooped off in the rain and got on the back of this open truck in Valdez and started on up over the highway to, first we stopped at a camp called Clearwater, and then we went on to a camp at Tok, which was a little settlement there, and entirely made up of construction workers. And then I moved on to the camp, I would have been on the southeast side of the river at the Tanana River, where Weldon Brothers had the contract to put the steel up on this bridge, and was there all summer.
How long were you in Alaska?
Well, I remained in Alaska at that time until early September of 1948, so it would be, what, 5.5 years about. Well, after working for the maintenance crew, as I mentioned earlier, on the highway, on the section between the border and Northway, I then went to Fairbanks, and I worked a winter in charge of the civilian camp at Ladd Field, and found that to be a miserable job. I was sort of a hotel keeper without a hotel. And spent my time taking care of complaints about why there weren't clean sheets on the bed, and I need another pillow, and the toilets won't flush, and all these things. And I somehow didn't find that to my liking, but I stuck it out for the winter, because, of course, in the wintertime, there was nothing else to do in the sense of work. But come spring, I got a release from that employment, and in those days you had to have a release from one job before you could go to another. This was provided by law to prohibit the crews just from jumping to job to job. And when I started with the job, I had the agreement with the man that hired me at Ladd Field that in the spring, if I wanted to, he would give me the release. And I signed on with Summers Construction Company, S-O-M-M-E-R-S, who was a small construction company out of Juneau, was building the airport at Nome. And so I went to Nome then, arriving first in Nome in June of 1944.
What was Nome like in June of 1944?
Well, Nome was on a war front footing in June of 1944. There were a great many servicemen there. There was a battalion of pretty tough kids from the Bronx that were stationed in Nome. And to say, it used to be said that we really wish the Japanese would come in and protect us from them. They were a very rough group. And Summers Construction Company had taken over some buildings in one of the hotels, the little hotels there, the Patterson Hotel, as living space for their employees. And they were working 2 10-hour shifts. And I was on the day shift and drove truck 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, for about 8 months. And then that winter I went back outside and then came back in the early spring and again worked for Summers at Nome.
Why
which
did
was
you stay at Nome for the winter?
Well, there was no reason to, and I had, I mean, literally no place to stay. The Summers people closed up their camps and everything in the winter, and there wasn't much to do there except sit around, you know, and which didn't appeal particularly to me. In retrospect, it might have proven to be a very interesting winter as I lived there and lay, you know, many years later on, but I didn't know that or sense that at the time. So I went out and came back then in the early spring and worked the second year for Summers, which was the beginning in about May of 45. And then the Germany surrendered in May of 45, and then Japan in July. And when Japan surrendered, the construction work on the on Marks Air Force Base, as it was known in Nome then, ceased. I stayed on a couple of months with Summers Construction Company inventorying all the equipment and everything they had there, which, as I understood, was to be taken over by the government and they were to be paid for it. And I was the only one anybody could find around there that could run a typewriter. So I sat at a typewriter with a piece of paper and my colleague would call off something like, 48 number LC9 screws, and then I'd type this down, see? And so this went on for quite a while to inventory all this. I doubt if anybody ever looked at that again, but we did it. And when the Summers job was about to end on that, the United States Marshal in Nome, Ben Mose, M-O-Z-E-E, offered me a position as a Deputy U.S. Marshal. And it sounded interesting, and so I took that job, and I was a Deputy Marshal for Ben, one of his staff, from sometime in August of 1945 until I left to go back out to school, to go to law school. In the first of September 1948, I was there a little over 3 years.
What did you do as Deputy Marshal?
Well, of course, in those days, in territorial days, the Marshal was the only law enforcement of the territory outside of local police forces within municipalities. The state troopers were organized in just the last years of... at least they were organized so there was a presence in Nome. Just the very last years of territorial status. Now, maybe they existed to some limited extent elsewhere, the territorial troopers that later became the state troopers. So the marshals had all law enforcement responsibilities outside of the city limits. And Nome was the only incorporated town in the 2nd Division, as I recall it, at that time. And so we had all the law enforcement responsibilities out of Nome in the whole 2nd Division, from Hooper Bay to Barter Island, you know. And I did a great deal of traveling. Then I was a bachelor, and I was the only bachelor in the office, and I did a great deal of the traveling. by Umiak, by bush plane, by dog team, by whatever method was needed to get where I had to go. And Umiak is a native skin boat. Umiak, as I understand it, in the native language means woman's boat, because in the old days the women did the paddling while the men sat, which is, if one considers ERA, is not the thing to talk about. But that's where the name comes from, as I understand it. When I went, we were in the days of outboard motors. So, and the women weren't along at all. They were not included. And I would charter, go to some village, and one time I went down to Stebbins Village, which is down off the mouth of the Yukon River, with warrants of arrest for two individuals, and I remember one was named Timothy Snowball, and the other's name was John Teapot. Well, I got there and found that Timothy Snowball, who suspected my arrival, had left and had gone into a fish camp near Point Romanzoff. It's quite a ways down the coast. There's now a large White Alice site there, but there wasn't there, of course, in those days. A great bluff that sticks out over the sea. And so Von der Heidt, deputy marshal, getting his man, like the FBI, I hired an Umiak and two fellows to take me to the fish camp. And we came wheeling into the fish camp, and there was Tim Snowball, much surprised to see me. And so I took them back to Unalakleet, where the closest U.S. commissioner resided, whose name was Stefan Ivanov. A well-known, he's a Russian ancestry, half Russian from the early days. He was an old man then. He was the commissioner, took them before Stefan, and they were sentenced to some few months in jail, and I'd take them back to Nome to serve their sentences.
Was there a jail in Nome?
Yes, The second, on the second floor east part of the old federal building in Nome. It's across the street from what is now the federal building in Nome, and it's now given over to commercial enterprises. But the second floor was the federal jail, and they were housed there in rather nice comfort for their sentences, and then when released, taken out and put on airplanes to go home. And so anyway, I traveled a great deal, and I was also, of course, in Nome a lot of the time, too. I was not the only one that traveled, however. I just did a lot of it.
Who were the other attorneys or court people in Nome at the time?
At that time, in the beginning of my service as a deputy marshal, O.D. Cochran was alive, again, a very old man by then, and still practicing in Nome. And an individual by the name of C.C. Tanner was practicing there. He was not an old-time Nome attorney, that is, from the early days, as was O.D. Cochran. And Ira Orton came to Nome on the first boat in the summer and left on the last boat in the fall and practiced there during the summer. And he also was an early-day attorney, but again, well along in years by then. And used to come in just for the summer months and practice a little law. And they were the three that were Seattle, as I recall. Yes.
Did he have practice back there too?
Yes, he did. And he had a son who was an attorney who came to Nome just a very few times and found no fascination in the practice of law in Nome. This is not a criticism of the gentleman. He just didn't like it for whatever reasons and didn't ever come back. And both Ira Orton and O.D. Cochran have been dead for many years now. O.D. Cochran died during the time I was a deputy marshal, I would say, it would have been, what, in maybe 1947 in Nome. And Orton died not long after that, I don't think. They were the last of the early day lawyers that were still practicing in Nome.
Where did they come?
both were there in Gold Rush times. Exact dates, I have no idea, but both were there from early days. Well, to a large extent, perhaps, but things had changed so much, you know, from the early days when mining was a great rush, and there was a great deal of activity and litigation, and it sort of simmered down to a fairly slow pace, comparatively speaking, through the years of the 20s and 30s and 40s then, where the big mining company, originally the Wild Goose Mining Company, and then it later became the USSR and M, United States Smelting, Refining, and Mining Company, owned by the Guggenheim interests in Boston. And it now operates under a different name, UV Industries, I think. They're still operating in Nome. They closed down in 65, but started up again when the price of gold went up a few years ago. Yes, most of the litigation in the Nome court involved things like conflicts over mining claims and over contracts to do with mining ventures and claim jumping and sluice box robbing and, you know, things of that nature that sound very strange to the world now. But the great deal of the litigation was that. Plus, of course, a smattering of the normal civil things of, you know, like divorces and so forth, and there were the smattering of what you might call a more normal criminal cases of larcenies or assaults or things like that, you know, that went on. But it ceased to be a very busy court as time went by.
Did Odie Cochran have an office there?
Yes. He had an office in the big mining company building. He represented the mining company, and they provided office space for him. That building is now torn down and gone. There are photographs of it. It's a great, huge wooden structure of a building that originally was built by a sect of Catholic sisters as a hospital. And later, they abandoned the hospital and, well, maybe that isn't a fair way to put it. I don't know about abandoning the hospital, but for whatever reason, they ceased to operate the hospital, and the mining company, the big mining company, bought the building. And it was made into apartments on the upper floors for their high officials, the manager and assistant manager and so forth. and then there were some apartments in the lower levels of it too. And then they had their main office there, and O.D. Cochran had his office in that building too.
So O.D. Cochran represented the Guggenheim?
Yeah, he represented the mining company, which was owned by Guggenheim. There was no Guggenheim in their name, but it was owned by the Guggenheim interest. And he represented them, I think, for many years, really, up until his death, because he still had offices in that building when he died. And I think he was in his 80s when he died. I don't know exactly, but I'm sure he was in his 80s. And I think Ira Orton was certainly in his 80s or very close to them when he died. But he didn't die in Nome. He died in Seattle. And
who did Ira Orton represent?
I don't recall him as representing specifically any major interests in those days. He may well have, in earlier years, represented. There were many larger mining companies in the earlier days, and they sort of petered out into the one big one. excuse me. He just came in, as I told you, in the summer months and sort of did a little of this, I think more for recreation and to come back to the old stamping ground sort of a thing, than really to seriously practice much law. He didn't say no to people that came in to his office for legal work, but he had from many years before only been there during the spring, summer, and fall months and gone during the winter. And of course that's not too good a basis to have a successful continuing law practice when you're gone that much. And but he had represented in the early years defendants in some pretty well-known criminal cases in murders and claim jumping cases and so forth through the years. The names of which I couldn't tell you anymore, if I ever knew them. They were before my time, before 1944 or 3.
Do you remember any of the stories of his cases?
Well, I remember one story they talked about in which he represented a defendant that was tried 3 times and finally acquitted, a murder charge. He was convicted twice and reversed on appeal twice by what was called the Supreme Court of Alaska, in other words, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco was called the Supreme Court of Alaska, unofficially. And then it was finally tried a 3rd time, and his client was acquitted. I can remember people talking about that case, but it happened before I came. So I don't know much more about it than that. Well, it was sent back for a new trial. Yeah, twice. And of course, then, you see, you had to take a boat out to Seattle and then the train to San Francisco. It was a long process to go to the Ninth Circuit. It was not like it is today where you get on Western Airlines at 9 o'clock in the morning and you're in San Francisco at 2:30 in the afternoon, the same time, you know. It was 10 or 12 days to Seattle on the boat, and the boats only went once a month or once every 5 weeks, and, you know. So it was quite an interesting, but apparently a case of great notoriety in the community at the time, but I don't recall it.
Did a lot of cases go to the Ninth Circuit?
No. It was a very expensive thing to appeal to the Ninth Circuit for the reasons I just stated. Transportation alone for an attorney was very expensive. And it had to be a client of substantial means to afford the Ninth Circuit. Of course, in criminal cases, then I think they could federally appointed lawyers and so forth. I was appointed when I practiced law in Nome in the years that I did when I came back after law school. I was the only practicing lawyer there, and I got all the criminal cases by appointment. It was a foregone conclusion. And so that existed. They were paid out of C fund. C fund, the letter C, which was a fund that, I don't know, but it was a fund that all fines and forfeitures from the territorial courts went into C fund. And then the district judge was free to utilize that fund for any legitimate purpose to do with the court, from constructing buildings to paying court-appointed counsel, and you were paid from C fund. And
so you were paid to defend?
Yes, you were paid. You were paid what the district judge thought you should get, and you had no appeal or no recourse.
What did he pay you?
Well, let me think. As I recall, it was set up not on an hourly basis, but on a case basis. You got $200 for defending a defendant in a felony case, and $100 for a misdemeanor. It wasn't big money, Pam, in today's world. And I remember one time I got a check from C Fund for about $1,200. I've been very busy, and it seemed like a fortune in the, in the early 50s. So it was, but I was the only one there. So whether they liked it or not, it was me.
What about C.C. Tanner? What kind of law did he
practice? You practiced general law in Nome. There was no, you know, in a town of 2,800 or 3,000 people, you didn't specialize in anything. And he just practiced general civil and criminal law. I don't know much about C.C. Tanner, his background. He was there when I first went to Nome in 1944, practicing law. And he died right after I came back from law school. He died in a hunting accident, very tragically. And I later leased his office space from his widow. He had a fairly decent, small little law library in his office, and I leased it from his widow, Ella Tanner, and during the time I practiced law there. He was not an attorney from early Gold Rush days at all. He came in to Nome, I believe, in about the mid-30s, and I don't know from where. there always was a little element of mystery about Tanner and where he was from and how he came to know him and everything. But he was a competent man. He was a good lawyer and did a good job for his client. His widow is still alive and lives in Nome, Ella Tanner. I liked him. He was always very nice to me. And I know when I came back from law school, why he was, he saw me, I'm sure, as a competitor, but he was very cordial to me and said, if there's anything I can do to help you or get you started or anything, why come in. And then, well, I went in as U.S. attorney for 2.5 years, and it was during the time I was U.S. attorney that he died in this accident. So when I left the U.S. attorneyship in March of 1953, there was no one practicing law in Nome.
Who's the judge when you were the deputy marshal?
Kehoe, Joseph Kehoe, who is really much more widely known for his paintings, his watercolors, than his judicial work. Joe was a very hot-tempered Irishman. And he resigned as a judge in Nome, and he was a good friend of Ernest Greening's, and he went to Juneau as in a position which is known as Secretary of Alaska. That's Lieutenant Governor, really, but in territorial days it was Secretary of Alaska. And so he left Nome, the judgeship, during the time I was 2+ a little bit years I was gone to law school. Why, he resigned as the judge and went to Juneau as Secretary of Alaska with Ernest Greening, and then of course went out of office when Ernest did, a year or two later, and retired in, I believe, Portland, Oregon. And he's gone now, and so is his widow, Catherine, is also dead.
Do you know when he came to Nome?
It would have been, I believe, in about 42 or 3. And he was the judge there. Maybe 44 would be a better guess, and it is a guess, because those judges in territorial days serve 4-year terms, and he served a 4-year term and was reappointed, and it was during his second term, in about 1949 or 50, that he resigned and became Secretary of Alaska.
What had he done before he was judge?
He was a practicing attorney, and he'd practiced in the early days in Cordova, and perhaps even in Valdez, and he came to the judgeship from there. He succeeded a judge that was there. Judge Gore was there during the Hoover administration, and then there was another judge who was from Tennessee, who served a term in between Judge Gore, who left in 32, and when Kehoe came in. That judge was there for several years. And for some reason, being old, I can't remember his name all of a sudden. I never met him. I keep wanting to say Judge Alexander, but I don't think that's right. No, Judge Alexander sat in Juneau. And can't say his name. He's the one who was known as being so terribly penurious. Tight, a tightwad. That's a nice word for a tightwad. And I remember talking to a grocer there who told me that his wife had come into the meat market and bought 2 pork chops for their dinner. And the next day she brought one back. She said, for credit, she said, I want to gag, my husband didn't feel good last night and didn't eat his. So maybe this is a good place to end. Don't you have another appointment?
At 4:30. 4:30.
Oh, okay.
What kind of reputation did
Keogh
have? Was he a tough judge, a lenient judge?
I don't recall any special reputation he had. the Nome Court, as I say, in the days he was there, was not a really very busy one. And I think he helped out a little bit here and there, but not to any great extent. He was gone from Nome on and off quite a lot. He and Catherine used to go outside and vacation and so forth. I don't think his reputation follows him as a judge. It follows him as an artist. And his watercolors now are very, they're lovely watercolors. And they're expensive to buy if you can find one. And he did many in Nome, and he did quite a few in Cordova. The local museum, the Anchorage Historical and Fine Arts Museum, has 7 or 8 of his watercolors.
When you were deputy marshal, did you have any big cases that stand out in your mind, besides going on?
I recall cases, civil cases that were in trial to do with mining conflicts, mm-hmm. Over contracts for mining property and claim jumpings, and I can remember criminal cases in which that were tried over people that got that were accused of getting their hand in the sluice box and so forth. I don't recall any cases of any real notoriety during those years.
What made you decide to go to law school?
Well, I guess being a deputy marshal. I had gone to law school really in pre-med. And as I told you, right, soon after I graduated from Albion, my father died, and it, of course, changed a lot of my plans. But the longer I was gone from school, the more I became convinced that medicine really wasn't my career. And of all things, I don't think you can go into medicine without a strong commitment. You know, I don't think anybody should go into medical school reluctantly or with doubts. So my experience as a deputy marshal really whetted my interest in the law, plus the further fact that my mother had remarried, and she married a prominent Chicago lawyer, John King. And although living in Nome, I did not see a great deal, but we were very fond of one another. And the two sort of suggested to me that maybe I should think about going back to school and going to law school. And I did. And to answer your question specifically, I think it was probably the experience as a deputy marshal that edged me a little bit toward that, and the abandonment of medicine. Yes.
Why did you decide to go back to Nome?
Well, I had lived in Nome for over 5 years by then, and I had a lot of good friends there. I found it a very interesting place to live in those days, and probably still is. I don't know why it wouldn't be. Everybody's heard of Nome, you know, and a lot of interesting people came to Nome I met, and interestingly enough, my little law office was right on the main drag, right next to the major hotel in town, and a lot of people used to just stop in and chat, not only attorneys, but just tourists and people that came through town see the sign in the window. It got to be a problem, as a matter of fact, because I wasted a lot of time, really, chatting with people who came in and were interested, and to whom I responded, and that was fine, and I don't mean that I was that I resented, I don't, it was, but it nevertheless started to take a lot of time to be sort of the host of the town, so to speak, and but it was a fascinating place to practice law, and as it turned out, I didn't have any way to know this at the time either, except for a very short period of time, I was the only practicing attorney in the entire Second Division all the time I was there. And I had practice from Barter Island to Hooper Bay, you know, and all around, and a lot of Mayo practice M-A-I-L, that is, Mayo practice.
What's your Mayo practice?
Well, a great deal, but I had an interesting practice in male divorces that were handled entirely by male, that I just facetiously refer to as my Sears Roebuck divorces because they were by mail, which everybody in Nome ordered things from Sears or Wards by mail. But I don't mean to belittle it by calling it that. It really served a very valuable function and purpose. And by the method that was used, individuals in far outlying areas were able to obtain a divorce to which they were entitled under the law that they could not possibly have afforded to do otherwise. And it amounted to interrogatories. I prepared interrogatories based on a court order. I would move for a court order that the proof be presented by interrogatory. And then I prepared interrogatories and sent them out, we'll say, just to someone in Barrow who had written me about getting a divorce. And I would get a letter that they wanted to get a divorce, and then I would write back and tell them the cost, which in those days were $225 for a divorce. You know, sounds pretty lean today, but tell them the cost. And I guess to be fair to me, I did a lot of pro bono work when it appeared to me that genuinely a person couldn't afford it, and the need was there, and so, but. Most people paid or paid something, and most people paid the cost. And I would tell them what I how it worked, and always suggested that if they could come to Nome personally when I asked them to come, it would be better. But in 90% of the cases, I would get an answer back that they had no money to come to Nome. To come to Nome from Barrow, for example, or to come up from Hooper Bay, those were expensive trips for Native people in those outlying areas that had children and, you know, were trying to hold body and soul together, so to speak. And so I would hear back from them, and so I would get and file the complaint. This, of course, worked only if, under two instances, if the defendant in the divorce proceeding would sign what we called a waiver and consent. Or you could advertise him out or her out, so to speak, as it was called, by putting an ad in the paper, the sum. Well, there's still, I see them in the paper and noticing people of divorce proceedings. If there was anything in conflict, for example, the custody of children or property or something like that, it didn't work. But it was rare that the divorces from the outlying areas involved that. And almost all of the cases, the defendant would sign a waiver and consent. And I would have the Walter Hodge would sign an order that the proof could be presented in sworn answers to interrogatories. And so I would prepare the interrogatories, of course, individually in each case, and postmasters in those days could administer oaths as a notary. And I don't know whether that's still true under Alaska law or not, but it was then. And I would send them out to them and tell them to take them to the postmaster, who normally was an individual in the community of at least some limited knowledge and background, and question, oh, please state your name, and then I'd leave a space for it to be written in. And where do you live, and then go through all the various questions of that were required for the proof, and then the individual would sign it and swear to it before the postmaster, who would send it back. Then I would move the court for a time. I'd call the clerk and say I had a divorce to present, and I would stand in court and read the sworn questions and answers, and the judge would find the proof to be sufficient and grant the decree, and he would sign the decree of divorce, which I would mail back to the person, and I never saw him. But it performed a valuable service at the time. It sounds sort of naive and maybe even in a way silly now, but it did. And that wasn't my only practice. I don't mean to say that, but I did quite a lot of that, especially in the last, say, 3 or 4 years I practiced in Nome. I had really quite a business going.
I was
Divorces became fashionable all of a sudden. The people seemed to, they, instead of just sort of walking out on each other and going somewhere else, it became somewhat the fashionable thing to get a divorce. I'm not sure fashionable is exactly the right word, but I don't know what synonym, sort of prestigious, perhaps. And so I had quite a business going, and mail would come into the Nome post office addressed Lawyer, Nome, Alaska, and the post office would dump it into my box. And frequently it was a big fat envelope, and I'd open it up, and there would be, $3 $5 bills, a $10 bill, $16 $1 bills, and so forth, of money that they had saved and gotten together, and often they couldn't pay any more, and sometimes it didn't even pay the costs. The filing fee was $25 and so forth. Sometimes it didn't, and sometimes I never got any money, and sometimes people didn't pay that really could have, and, you know, the same problems that anybody in private practice has today. But,
Did these mostly native?
Yes. Not 100%, but the great majority were native people of the various villages spread all over the whole 2nd Division. And word kind of got around on it a little bit, and as I say, I had a rather thriving business in that for a while, and for a few years. But I did lots of other work, as I told you earlier. I did all the criminal defense work of the court, unless the individual had the funds to retain counsel privately, in which case they may have chosen, for example, to get a Fairbanks attorney, which happened a few times, but even those with private funds would sometimes retain me, and I would defend them in the case. And then I had general civil practice of somewhat of the nature that I've already mentioned, of mining and conflicts and claims over contracts. And then I had an office practice, too, of drawing contracts for the sales of property and deeds and bills of sale and powers of attorneys, and all anything you can about think of that would come under the heading of general practice of law.
Was there another U.S. attorney there?
Yes. Yes, when I resigned.